This is our last talk of the War College here at CelesticCon 2014. I'm Dana Lombardi, and I'm introducing Frank Chadwick, one of our guests of honor here at this year's convention, as he has been in the past. He's going to be talking about today the Guadalcanal surface naval actions, and they are also, in addition to the historical aspects, you're going to talk about why they're an inspiration for your fiction series. Is that right?
Well, if we have time, I mean, I know we're on a tight schedule, and this is a big subject. So,
okay, yeah. Well, Frank, let's hear it. Tell us all about the Guadalcanal campaign.
Okay. I'm not a big Pacific theater guy as a general rule, but I have been interested in the Guadalcanal campaign for a long time, and I kind of approached it. I'm mostly a land guy, and so most of what my interest in Guadalcanal was the land combat, and then of course it occurred to me that the air was pretty important too. And eventually I came around to the naval and discovered the most interesting, the most interesting part of the campaign, which is the naval stuff. Although really, a lot of it is aeronaval. And I would say that I will begin by saying there's this book that came out recently, Neptune's Inferno, by James D. Hornfisher. Great book. He kind of made his bones as a naval historian with his book, The Last Stand of the Tin Can Sailors, which is about the U.S. destroyers at Leyte. And that really made his reputation as a historian. And he's followed it up with this book, which is a terrific book. It's about the naval actions off Guadalcanal. And a lot of the material today comes from this book. There's also another book. I would say the one battle he doesn't cover particularly well, or at least it's a perfunctory coverage, is the Battle of Tessaforongo, which is the last surface action there. And there's a book out on that battle called The Battle of Tessaforongo, which was written by a guy who was the gunnery officer on one of the U.S. destroyers at the battle. And he wasn't happy with the coverage that the destroyers got, and so like 30 years later, he finally decided he was going to research this and write a book about it. And it's a terrific book, and we'll have a little time to talk about Tessaforongo at the end. But the whole campaign in Guadalcanal, which is really the last from August to the end, from August of 1942 until the end of 1942, is such an interesting naval campaign because it illustrates stuff far beyond just how good the ships are. And the first thing that stands front and center that influences this that I'd never really understood before was how important logistics was to the conduct of the naval campaign at Guadalcanal. The naval campaign at Guadalcanal is conducted mostly by, aside from the carrier task forces, which intervene a couple of times, there's two pretty good-sized carrier actions that take place during this campaign as well. But the surface stuff is almost exclusively fought with cruisers and destroyers. Towards the end of it, the U.S. gets a couple battleships in. The Japanese have a couple battleships, but mostly they don't get into it. They are committed on occasion. Why aren't they committed more? And why are there only two U.S. battleships involved, when at that time the U.S. already has three of the Pearl Harbor battleships repaired and back in service, and has moved three additional battleships from the Atlantic into the Pacific? So Task Force 1, which is the Pacific Fleet's battle task force, at this time consists of six battleships, and they spend virtually this entire campaign tied up on the west coast of the United States of America. Why? And the answer is that the old battleships really are fuel hogs. So to put Task Force 1 at sea with all of its escorts, all those six old battleships with their escorts, consumes 300,000 barrels of oil a month.
Wow.
And that is the total storage capacity in the Pacific theater of oil. Okay? Now, they're at the beginning of 42 anyway. Now, they're working to make more tank farms and all this other stuff. But basically, to put that task force at sea and maintain it there is pretty much going to take the entire capacity of the Pacific theater storage continually to keep them at sea. In addition to the fact that because the U-boat war is having so much success again in the Atlantic, They're taking, and off the coast of the U.S. and the Caribbean, they're pulling tankers like crazy out of the Pacific and sending them to the Atlantic to make the to move oil around in the Caribbean and to move it across the Atlantic. As a result, there are at this time 7 tankers in the Pacific. The United States Navy has a total of 7 tankers in the Pacific. So, like, at one point, a tanker gets lost, and you like you read about it, they lost this tanker. You go, they lost a tanker. What? Well, that's like 1/7 of all the tankers they have in the Pacific. So it's a really big deal. They've got to be very careful. Essentially, they have to make a decision between operating Task Force One, the battleships in the Pacific, or operating all the carriers. Well, what do they pick?
Carriers.
Okay, yeah, carriers, yeah, of course, you know. So the carriers are operating there. The old slow battleships are tied up on the West Coast. When they start getting the fast battleships, and they start getting them really about, as this campaign's going on, they get, you know, one and then another and then another, they're much more fuel efficient. So the fast battleships, they can actually operate with the carriers, and they're not, you know, really burning the fuel. So that's a really important logistical consideration for the U.S. For the Japanese, the big consideration is just not just storage, it's total supply of oil. They just don't have a lot of oil. So they've got a lot of naval assets, but they've only got so much oil, so they can only use them so much each month. And the battleships, again, really suck a lot of oil. So when they can't operate their carriers and battleships continuously, they have to decide and make, they have to save up and sometimes make a major effort, but they can't make a continuous major effort. So you see these things like the Yamato and the Kirishima and the Hiei all tied up in Rabaul, and you wonder, why aren't they coming out? Well, the reason they're not coming out is they don't have the oil to ship them. So big deal. Logistics is a very big deal in this campaign, and really its hand lies heavily on the decisions that all these admirals make all the time. Second thing that's really, really important in this campaign is leadership. Leadership at the top, leadership at the operational level. Gormley is the commander of the South Pacific Theater at this time. They create this theater for him with the Guadalcanal campaign. Put him in charge of it, and we don't really know how to have theaters yet very well. I mean, this is right at the beginning of the war, and we're still figuring all this stuff out. So he's this theater commander, he's commanding the South Pacific area, the South Pacific area, trying to figure out what that means, trying to figure out what his authority is, and trying to figure out how to go about commanding it. And he has some real problems. He tries to do everything himself. He doesn't delegate very well, and he ends up covered up in paperwork and has some major, in retrospect, major lapses, major problems in command. He never gets out and visits the Marines. He never gets out and visits any of his operational naval ships or commands. He spends the whole time in the office understanding that he doesn't understand the capabilities and weaknesses of his own forces. But he just can't figure out how to get time away to do it because he's so overwhelmed with paperwork. About halfway through this, he's going to get replaced by a guy by the name of Halsey, and things will change, as you can imagine. The Japanese have a problem in that they have a very divided command. Although Yamamoto is technically in command, he does have to pay some attention to what the Army wants. And the Army really wants to be pushing in New Guinea, not in the Solomons. So for the first part of the battle, the Army's attention is really on New Guinea, and they kind of give some resources to Yamamoto to do this thing in the Solomons. Eventually, they come around, but possibly too late. But so there's some divided counsel among the Japanese. The last thing I think is really important as an overview is the mental posture of the combatants. The Americans going into this really don't have a war mentality yet. Strange as it may sound, I mean, there's been Pearl Harbor, so there was a surprise attack. Well, okay, we kind of got clobbered there, but then we went out and we had Midway. And boy, okay, well, these Japs aren't so tough now that, you know, they're not surprising us. And so, but the surface action, the surface component had really not engaged the Japanese yet. There'd been, most of the operations had been against the carrier force. So although we won a big win at Midway, and that gave the Navy a boost of confidence. It was kind of false confidence because nobody really knew what the Japanese surface component was like. And we were going to find out real quick, and we weren't going to like that much. But you really see in the initial things this kind of inability, but they had not yet psychologically adjusted to war, to the fact that they were at war and the urgency that that required. And you'll kind of see that right away. So those are just kind of some overviews, all right? On August 6th, we begin the Marines land on Guadalcanal, push back the construction troops that are the main garrison there, take Henderson Field. The transports begin unloading supplies, but because of the fuel shortage and because of the difficulty of refueling carriers at sea and because of how far they were operating from the base, the U.S. Navy had decided going in that they were only going to have a couple of days to unload supplies, at which point the carriers were going to have to pull out to refuel. And when the carriers pulled out, they couldn't do air cover, and so the transports were all going to pull out. But they thought they could get everything unloaded in the first couple of days. Actually, they weren't as efficient at unloading, because that's another thing we hadn't learned, is how to load for an invasion yet, since this was the first one. And there's a lot of controversy about the Navy pulling out and leaving the Marines. That was really a whole part of the plan. It was maybe not a good part of the plan, but it was kind of there all along. On the 6th, everything lands. On the 9th, we're getting ready to pull out because most of the transports and stuff are going to pull back on the 10th. But on the evening of the 9th, the Japanese send in a cruiser force to try to hit the transports while there were still transports unloading. The Japanese didn't really know how big a force was there. And on that night is the first naval battle at Guadalcanal, the Battle of Savo Island. The Allies had 6 heavy cruisers off Guadalcanal in the waters around Savo Island, and 6 destroyers. One of those heavy cruisers, which was the flagship of the task force, was pulled out, and it was they were having a conference with Fletcher, the overall naval commander, and the commander on the marine commander, and so one of those cruisers was not available. There were 5 cruisers there, 2 of them, and here's Guadalcanal, Savo Island is here. 2 of the cruisers are in the southern channel and 3 of the cruisers are up here in the northern channel. There were destroyers out here doing radar pickets. And the Japanese caught those cruisers completely by surprise. There had been a sighting of them by air by a New Zealand plane, but because, the New Zealanders sent it through their chain of command and there was no real hurry to get it anywhere because, again, no sense of urgency yet. There had been a couple sightings of people saying, a strange plane flying over the island. Okay, well, that's nice. There was a strange plane flying over. What does that mean? There were destroyer pickets out there, so we knew, they got radar. Well, the radar didn't have enough range to cover the whole area they were patrolling, so the Japanese got past the destroyer pickets without the destroyers really knowing it. And when they finally started sighting the Japanese, and the ships that sighted them transmitted a warning, it was in the middle of the watch. And there was a bunch of mid-watch administrative traffic that on ship, the channels were very limited, and so the radio channels were jammed with administrative chatter. And so the sighting reports didn't get through. But they did know how many guys were on sick call, and stuff like that, that important stuff, right? So the Japanese first hit the southern group of 2 cruisers, damaged one of them real badly, sank the other one, then came around Savo Island and hit the other group, and the other group caught them by surprise too. They saw the fight. I mean, it's a night action, but they saw look at all that shooting over there. They must be, I guess we're bombarding the shore, huh? Yeah, it must be it. Then they start feeling the underwater explosions when the long lance torpedoes are plowing into these cruisers. They must be dropping depth charges on a submarine. That must be it. Yeah. And it was just explaining all this stuff away. So they were caught not even at battle stations. The first thing they knew, a couple of guys saw, finally they saw the Japanese ships. even though it was at night. But the first thing they really knew that they were Japanese is when they just opened up and started hitting them. And so those three cruisers got nailed as well. By the result of the action was four cruisers sunk, one cruiser and two destroyers heavily damaged. The one cruiser that didn't get smashed was the one that wasn't in the action at all. The Japanese had two cruisers damaged. That's it. So the first naval action between the United States Navy and the Japanese, surface night naval action, is a massacre. I mean, it's really a disaster. Our cruiser forces effectively destroyed. Not that it affected the decision to pull out the next day. That decision had already been made, but now for sure everybody's going home. So everybody pulls out the next day. But the carriers, and the carriers withdrawn. At this time, the U.S. has three carriers in the area, and we're going to track these carriers because this is an important piece of, because they're real important, particularly at the beginning, but they remain important throughout this. The Enterprise, the Saratoga, and the Wasp are the three carriers at this time operational in the South Pacific. They pull back on the 10th, followed by the transports. On the 20th, 10 days later, Henderson Field finally becomes operational, and we put some planes on Henderson Field. And this is a game changer for the rest of the campaign. I mean, this is at 10 days where the Marines are really vulnerable. But once land-based air gets on Henderson Field, the Japanese find themselves in a very difficult position. And they hadn't really figured this out until this point. Because they weren't thinking maybe as proactively as they needed to. But what happens once land-based air is firmly established on Henderson Field is that the Japanese are flying from Rabaul, and their naval forces are coming from Rabaul. For the Japanese, nobody's really very good at night and all-weather operations at this time anyway. So when you're flying from Rabaul, if you take off at dawn, you get to Rabaul about midday, and then you can turn around and fly back and get there at dusk. So you can actually make that round trip in one day, take off in daylight, land at last light. The problem is, that means that every day you show up over Henderson Field at exactly the same time. So your pilots are really tired, your fighters don't have a lot of fuel for maneuvering, and the Americans know when you're coming. I mean, in addition to having coast watchers to say the planes are coming over, they know there's this pretty narrow window when the Japanese can attack Henderson Field by air, and so they're ready. They're up. There's a tremendous tactical advantage in the air campaign from the position of Henderson Field relative to Rabaul. The second thing is that it's far enough from Rabaul that destroyers that take on, the destroyers and fast warships can kind of start the run down there in the afternoon or something, and at night finish the run to Guadalcanal, operate at night off Guadalcanal, turn around and get back out of air range. Join us.
Thank you. And
get back out of effective air range of Henderson Field by first light in the morning. So warships can make that run. Transports can't. Transports are slow enough that they can't get to Guadalcanal and unload and get out of there all at night. So the only way that you can get transports to Guadalcanal is to suppress Henderson Field and to make sure there's no planes operational off of Henderson Field. Otherwise, you can't bring more Japanese troops in by transport, and you can't bring supplies in by transport. The Japanese solve this by bringing troops in by destroyer. And you can bring troops in by destroyer and unload them, but you can't bring lots of tonnage of supplies in. So all through the campaign, the Japanese are landing lots of troops, but they're not able to supply them. They're effective, they don't get much artillery support because they can't get artillery ammunition. They have a very high sickness rate because they're malnourished. They're not getting enough food to the guys. They keep trying to put transports in, but to do that, they've got to shut Henderson Field down. And although they can bombard it a little bit by night, they really need to put battleships in there to really silence Henderson Field. And they can't run battleships very often, can they? Why? Fuel, right? The whole fuel problem. So all of this comes together in some interesting ways in the battle, and that kind of is the big puzzle of this battle for both sides. So, on the 20th, Henderson Field opens up. And the Japanese decide that they have to make a major push to take Henderson Field out. And so they put most of the fleet to sea. And this results in the Battle of the Eastern Solomons. This is a carrier battle. It's the first major carrier battle down there. The Battle of the Eastern Solomons on August 24th. The Allies have two carriers. I remember I told you they had three carriers, but they have a fuel problem. And so right before the Japanese push, they decide to pull the Wasp out to refuel. So as the Japanese come down with their major effort, we've only got the Enterprise and the Saratoga available. So two carriers, the one fast battleship we have available at that time, four cruisers and 11 destroyers. The Japanese have two carriers, a light carrier, two battleships, 16 cruisers, 25 destroyers, bigger surface fleet, but both about two carriers. The result is we sink a Japanese light carrier. One U.S. carrier, I think it's the Enterprise, is damaged and temporarily out of action. We lose about 20 aircraft, and the Japanese lose 75 aircraft, which is what really kind of turns the Japanese back. Even though one of our carriers gets banged up, because what happens is among those cruisers are two of our new anti-aircraft carriers, and the battleship is one of the new fast battleships, which has a terrific anti-aircraft armament, and it just puts up a curtain of fire that just brings down about 8 out of 10 Japanese planes in this one attack. So most of the planes that get back are heavily damaged, those that even get back to the carriers. So the Japanese aircraft components of the carriers really get shot up, and so the Japanese don't push their effort. That turns them back, and so both main fleets withdraw, and that's the end of October. At the end of August. Through September, both sides are kind of building up and kind of rethinking what's going on. The one other thing that happens like a few days after the Battle of the Eastern Solomons is that the Saratoga gets damaged by gets torpedoed and damaged. So the Enterprise is kind of back in service. The Wasp is now refueled, but the Saratoga's out. So we're down to two carriers for a while. Early September, the Hornet shows up, the aircraft carrier Hornet. So now we've got three carriers again. And so we've actually got a carrier superiority temporarily. On the third of the month, Task Force 64 is formed. And what Task Force 64 is for is it's a deliberately formed unit as a surface strike force to get into the close waters off Guadalcanal and fight at night against what's now becoming known as the Tokyo Express, which is the Japanese destroyers and cruisers coming down the slot. The destroyers dropping off troops, and the cruisers kind of bombarding Henderson Field at night. And that goes on, off and on. It's never quite enough to shut down Henderson Field, but it causes a continuous attrition of aircraft. So Task Force 64 is sunk on the 3rd. Then on the 15th, the Wasp, okay? The Wasp is sunk. In this place, in the operational area where the American carriers were operating southwest of Guadalcanal. That area, you may have heard the expression Torpedo Junction. That's the area because the Japanese put a lot of submarines in there, and there's a lot of submarine and anti-submarine action going on. The Wasp is sunk by the Japanese submarine I-19 in the single most effective 6-torpedo spread in history. The I-19... I shouldn't laugh. I mean, it's not funny. They fire 6 torpedoes, and the Wasp, the Americans operate their carriers in separate task forces. So the Wasp's task force is here, and the Enterprise's task force is over here, like 2 miles away. The I-19 fires its 6-torpedo spread. Two of those torpedoes hit the Wasp. The other four keep going, but the long lance torpedo is long range, and it gets into the Enterprise task force like 2 miles away. One of them hits the destroyer O'Brien and knocks its bow off, puts it out of service for a while, and the other one puts the battleship North Carolina out of service. I mean, they hit four ships sank one of them, put two out of action. One of them, our only fast battleship available at that time, cut our carrier and cut our carrier force in half. That's pretty impressive, and really lucky. That's about what happens in September. Everybody's getting ready for, everybody's building up and getting ready for October. On the first week of October, the Japanese managed to land about 10,000 additional troops by means of the Tokyo Express. They bring almost a full division on the Guadalcanal, getting ready for a major offensive. And to support that offensive, the Japanese need to put, again, they need to put Henderson Field out of action. So they send a bombardment force down on October 11th, and that gets intercepted by this newly formed Task Force 64. So that's the night battle of Cape Esperance on October 11th. Now, the Battle of Cape Esperance, the Task Force 64 was originally formed in September. About a week and a half, 2 weeks before the Battle of Cape Esperance, they got a new commander in the task force. That was an admiral by the name of Scott, who was a very aggressive admiral and who really spent that whole time training every day and every night that task force for night actions. And he really drilled the cruisers. He did a terrific job of getting these guys ready for night actions. And so they were really anxious to tie into the Japanese. It seems like every one of these battles begins with the Americans shooting themselves in the foot. There's something that goes wrong in every one of these battles. And what happens at the opening of the Battle of Cape Esperance is that Scott's task force, which consisted of, what has he got? He's got two heavy cruisers, two light cruisers, and five destroyers. The five destroyers were kind of added at the last minute. But he's got his four cruisers that are the core of his task force, two destroyers in front, three destroyers behind. And he's going to make a turn to come in front of the Japanese because he's with the radar. He sees the Japanese, and the Japanese aren't aware of his task force yet. And so he says column turn. He signals column turn to the left, and that means that the lead ship turns, and then the next ship, and then the next ship, and the next ship. The lead destroyer turns, but the lead cruiser, being used to it always being a cruiser task force, also turns and breaks his line. And the reason that's bad is because the one thing that all these admirals are really terrified of is friendly fire at night. Because it's night, you've got all these ships going around, and he wants to make sure everybody's in line and he knows where they are. And the first thing that happens is the line's broken. And the destroyers are now out here, and the cruisers are in here, and the Japanese are in here. And he knows he's going to end up blowing these destroyers up. And so as soon as they end up opening fire on the Japanese, Scott's convinced they're firing on his destroyers. He tells his ships to cease fire. Half of them just ignore him, including his flagship, by the way. He's down on the Admiral's Bridge signaling all ships cease fire, and the captain of the flagship is saying, fire at will. And then leans over there and says, pardon me, Admiral, or with your permission, or excuse me, or something. But basically just yells down to Scott, I'm shooting at Japanese, you're wrong. And so they kind of get things sorted out eventually, that they're not firing at the Jap at their own destroyers. Then they open fire again. And at that point, then the American destroyers do walk into the fire, and the two lead destroyers do get sunk or shot up real bad, but they really shoot up the Japanese as well. At Esperance, the Japanese have a cruiser and three destroyers sunk, and another heavy cruiser damaged, and the Americans had one cruiser and one destroyer sunk, a light cruiser and a destroyer damaged. So, I mean, it was close losses, but, I mean, it wasn't the massacre it was before. And the Japanese are really, really kind of set back on their heels after the Battle of Sable Island, they thought, well, the Americans are pushovers. And when the Americans really chew them up pretty good at Esperance, it changes. The Japanese begin having a different notion of the Americans that they're facing. So, that's Esperanza. That turns back the effort to bombard Henderson Field, and that disrupts the attempts at a Japanese offensive there. On the 18th, that was on the 11th. On the 18th, Halsey replaces Gormley as commander of the South Pacific. And Halsey has a completely different philosophy of leadership. He delegates an awful lot of stuff. He gets out and sees that, you know, gets to, he actually spends some time on Guadalcanal itself. He meets with a lot of the crews, inspects a lot of the ships. But the main thing was that Gormley had a very tentative approach to how to use his forces. He would give orders that were at the same time vague but also restrictive. As soon as Halsey takes over on the very shortly after he takes over on the 18th, they get word that the Japanese are sortying, making another major push with the combined fleet. So it's the 18th. The actual battle takes place on the 25th, which is called the Battle of Santa Cruz. Halsey puts everything he's got out there. They're already out operating. He sends them north. And he gives, right before the Battle of Santa Cruz, he gives his order to the U.S. fleet under his command. And his order is strike, repeat, strike. That's it. Go find somebody and sink them. I mean, that's his, that's his orders. And it's the U.S. naval forces under Halsey's command become much more aggressive. At Santa Cruz, some you could argue that maybe they become too aggressive because it's not all that successful a battle, but we have two carriers there, a battleship, three heavy cruisers, three anti-aircraft cruisers, 13 destroyers. The Japanese have three carriers, a light carrier, two battleships, five heavy cruisers, and 18 destroyers. So they've got an edge in carriers at this point. We end up losing a carrier sunk. Who gets sunk there?
I think Hornet.
Hornet gets sunk. And we have a carrier sunk, a destroyer sunk, a carrier, a battleship, a heavy cruiser, a light cruiser, and three destroyers damaged. The Japanese lose a carrier, a light carrier, a cruiser, and four destroyers damaged. We lose 81 airplanes, they lose 99 airplanes. You know, so again, in that one, both sides kind of, they take some hits, but the air groups, particularly the Japanese air group, gets shot up pretty good. That effort of the combined fleet, again, is kind of turned back by air losses. They're unable to suppress Henderson Field. They're unable to get a lot of transports in there. So in November, there's a major push that's going to be made in November by the Japanese, and this involves finally sending battleships right down the slot. They're going to put two battleships off Henderson Field and just blow it off the map. And so that way the transports will be able to get down the next day because there's going to be no air, surface-based, land-based air to deal with them. The carriers are all... And by the way, the effect of the Battle of Santa Cruz is it's kind of the carriers are now off the board. We've lost carriers, we've had carriers damaged, we've had air groups shot up. Both sides' carriers are kind of off, and now it's a surface action versus land-based air. So if they can put their battleships off Henderson Field and just blow it off the map... Then they can bring the transports in. They can put troops ashore, and they can probably win the campaign.
Technically, those battleships were actually battle cruisers.
The Hiei and the Kirishima.
The Kongo class were battle cruisers.
Yeah. Well,
they were refitted between the wars, but classified they are still battle cruisers because they're.
You're probably right. That's not the sources that I've read what they've said, but that's a terminology difference. They're certainly no match for the fast battle U.S. fast battleships. Yeah. They're not a match for them. They're a lot older. But
Washington had a radar fire control problem.
Not in this battle, not yet. But that's a couple days later.
South Dakota did not.
Oh, what's that?
South Dakota had the problem.
I thought it was the Washington.
No, South
Dakota.
Okay.
It's not a fire control problem, but we'll get to that, all right? So what, in order to, when Halsey took over as commander of the South Pacific, it had an interesting unintended consequence. Admiral Callahan, who was Gormley's chief of staff, was left without a job because Halsey brought his own staff in. And so, but Callahan was a seagoing admiral, and so they gave him a command, and the command they gave him was Task Force 64, or it was now renamed, but it was basically the Surface Strike Force that Scott had commanded at Cape Esperance. Scott is now just the second tier and a superfluous admiral in the thing, because Callahan had like 6 weeks of seniority, I think, so he outranked Scott, it just in terms of time and service. So Callahan is now in charge of that task force, and they know that the Japanese are sending this bombardment force down, and all they've got right now is this surface strike force. So they throw it in, and this is called, sometimes it's called the first night action of Guadalcanal, mostly it's called the cruiser night action off Guadalcanal, November 11th, 1942. The Allies have two heavy cruisers, a light cruiser, two light anti-aircraft cruisers, eight destroyers. The Japanese have two battleships, a light cruiser, and 11 destroyers. Both sides shoot themselves in the foot at the beginning of this action. The Americans see the Japanese on radar, but Callahan doesn't want to open fire until he has visual confirmation that these are Japanese. And so... and the other thing is that the Callahan's...
Australians.
What's that?
It could be Australians.
Who knows, you know?
The truth is,
we don't know that that's why. We don't know, because Callahan didn't live to tell. The only two admirals the United States Navy loses in night actions in World War II were Callahan and Scott, both killed at this battle. Callahan's task force actually... with radar, sees the Japanese and the Japanese have no idea there, and they have crossed their T. They are in a perfect position to cross their T, and Callahan turns to parallel them, to go head on and come in close. And so they end up closing. Callahan doesn't open fire until they can actually see each other. I mean, they end up opening fire at very close range. And there's two battleships here. Well, in some ways that works to his favor, because they get so close that these heavy cruisers and light cruisers, the battleships, their armor, they're too close for their armor to stop this stuff. I mean, so when they start shooting, they really do shoot the Japanese battleships up. The other thing that works in their favor, and this is the Japanese a little bit shooting themselves in the foot, is that the Japanese, all their guns are loaded with short bombardment rounds, which are basically anti-personnel rounds that blow up in the air and drop bomblets. They're not armor-piercing rounds. And so they've got, and that's what's kind of in the hoists, too. So the first, when the Japanese start returning fire, anybody on the upper decks of these cruisers is in trouble, because there's these anti-personnel bomblets that land all over the place. But in terms of serious damage, there's not a lot right away. Now, when they finally get those things unloaded out the front end, and they start getting armor-piercing rounds up, and it's different. But the one of the things that makes a huge difference here, it was also true at the Battle of Cape Esperance, but the Japanese notice it here as well, is the new American light cruisers. The Japanese light cruisers really are light cruisers. The American new light cruisers that are showing up here, they showed up at Esperance and here, were like 12,000-13,000 ton light cruisers. So they're heavy cruisers for everything except the armament. Their armament is 6-inch guns instead of 8-inch guns. But they have 15 of them. They have 5 triple turrets with 6-inch guns. The rate of fire of the 6-inch gun is 10 rounds a minute. So these things are kicking out 150 rounds of 6-inch shells a minute, and the Japanese, in one of the after-action reports, refer to them as machine gun cruisers, because the tracer rounds were just almost continuous from these ships once they started shooting, and the fire control was the fire control was awfully good for the Americans. One of the 8-inch cruisers fired its first salvo; it was short. They raised 100 yards, fired their second salvo, and the report was no rounds hit water. You know, everything went into the ship. Into the ship they were firing, which was a battleship. So all these cruisers start shooting up the battleships, The result, and one of the battleships gets shot to pieces really quickly. I mean, just shot to pieces by all this close-range cruiser fire. The other one ends up turning away, partially because the situation gets real confused, partially because it loses sight of the target, but everything, it gets really messed up. By the end of it, the Americans lost a heavy cruiser, a light anti-aircraft cruiser, four destroyers sunk. Two heavy cruisers and a light anti-aircraft cruiser damaged, and two destroyers damaged. The Japanese lost a battleship. Now, it was really crippled that night and then finished off by land-based air from Henderson Field the next morning. And a destroyer sunk and a heavy cruiser damaged. So, at the end of this battle, our cruiser forces basically all sunk or destroyed. And we lost some destroyers. They lost a battleship sunk, and the bombardment of Henderson Field's been turned back. So the next morning, some transports get shot up from land-based air. But the Japanese decide, well, that's, you know, what do these guys have left? So they push with their one battleship. They add some more cruisers to it, and two nights later, on November 14th. The Japanese come back down the slot with a battleship, two heavy cruisers, two light cruisers, and nine destroyers. What have the Americans got left? We've got two fast battleships that were escorting carriers, which are now off the board. And we don't want to put them in this in close waters at night because they can get shot up by cruisers at close range, just like the Japanese battleships did, right? You don't want to put this, but that's all we've got left. All the Americans have left is two fast battleships, and what do they have for escorts? Two fast battleships and four destroyers is kind of what we can put in the field, and that's all we got. But we got they got us. You got to stop that. You know, the Japanese from the battleship bombardment. So on the night of 14-15 November is called the battleship night action, and that one should have been a turkey shoot, and it. Because the two fast battleships we had were really more than a match for that one Japanese battleship, and it would have been if it weren't for the fact that the chief engineering officer on the South Dakota, they'd been having a problem with a circuit breaker, that sometimes when they'd fire a salvo the circuit breaker would pop and they'd lose some of their electronics. And so he decided a good idea would be to just tie that circuit breaker down. So it couldn't.
What could possibly go wrong
with that? So when the action starts and not very long into the action, the circuit breaker trips, but since it's tied down, it just overloads, and they get these cascading overloads, and the South Dakota goes black. It just takes out its whole electronic system. And so for 5 minutes, the South Dakota has no electricity, you know, no internal communication. The radar's dead. A lot of the main battery can't function. The secondary battery does some firing on local control. And but the Japanese have already seen it. And so the Japanese see this kind of dead battleship sitting there, and they concentrate their fire on it. They don't do a lot of serious damage to it, interestingly enough, but they do a lot of damage to the upper works. They set a lot of fires because, again, they're hitting with a lot of bombardment ammunition early in the fighting. You know, so you've got a lot of anti-personnel stuff going off, decks starting to fire burn. So you've got so it becomes kind of this blazing wreck. It's not really a wreck. I mean, it's still in pretty good shape, but it looks like it's a blazing wreck. All the Japanese fire gets concentrated on that, and the Washington, the other battleship, is kind of behind it, and as everybody's shooting at the South Dakota, the Washington kind of comes out from behind it, and the Japanese, you know, kind of at the last minute see, oh, there's another battleship here. And when the Washington opens up, it really wrecks the other Japanese battleship. It ends up and beats it up pretty bad, and it sinks as well. So at the end of the battleship night action, we've had a battleship actually lightly damaged. It wasn't really as badly damaged as it looked at the time. We had one destroyer damaged, three destroyers sunk. All of our destroyers got really beat up at that battle. But we still got one good battleship fighting at the end of it. The Japanese lose a battleship, a destroyer sunk, and a heavy cruiser. The heavy cruiser damaged. And the big thing is that it just breaks the Japanese morale. At the end, by the end of this action, the Japanese honestly don't know. How are we doing on time, by the way?
5:16.
5:15. So we're getting close. The Japanese just don't know what it's. The attitude at this point is, what does it take these guys just won't stop. The Japanese are going to convince that the American Navy couldn't take these sort of losses and keep fighting. By the end of all the fighting, there's still one more battle to come, but it's an afterthought almost. That's Tassafaronga. But the total warship tonnage lost by the U.S. Navy in all these actions was 160,815 tons of warships. The Japanese total loss was 155,530. I mean, it was almost identical tonnage lost. But the U.S. aggressiveness kept getting. The U.S. became more and more and more aggressive. The more it seemed to the Japanese, the more it lost, and showed no signs of the morale breaking. And the Japanese, by the end of this, were punch drunk. I mean, they were really punch drunk from the punishment they'd taken. They may not be the best battleships, but the Kirishima and the Hiei were sentimental favorites in the fleet, and they were both sitting at the bottom of Iron Bottom Sound. And so there's really not much chance from then on that the Japanese think they can win. They keep running in some supplies for a while. The Battle of Tassafaronga is on November 30th when a cruiser force catches some Japanese destroyers coming in and doesn't like the fact much that it caught them. The Allies lost a heavy cruiser sunk and three heavily damaged. The Japanese lost one destroyer. Because even that late in the campaign, the Allies didn't understand the capabilities of the long lance torpedo. I mean, now we kind of, those of us who are kind of geeky about, the naval war know about the long lance. The Allies still didn't. And so the cruiser admiral at Tassafaronga sees the Japanese on radar and says, we're safe at this range. We'll just wait until we get a little closer until the gunnery solution's better and we'll open up. And at this range, with impunity, they can't hit us with torpedoes. And then the cruisers start blowing up. And they never did really figure out what happened to them. It wasn't until after this campaign they begin understanding how really capable the long lance is. The other thing at Tassafaronga that's kind of interesting is that the U.S. after-action report reports about six Japanese destroyers sunk. They only hit one destroyer, and they finally ended up sinking it after it was dead in the water. And the reports are, there's a destroyer coming and it's closing on us real fast, and we kept shooting and shooting and shooting until it finally blew up and disappeared. And what they were looking at was their gunnery radar, which was pretty good gunnery radar, but they weren't reading it correctly. They were, after they had identified a destroyer and start shooting at it, they were picking up their gun splashes as radar echoes. And the splashes were short, they'd see, look, the destroyer is getting closer, it's closing on us. And so they would correct down, and basically they were chasing their own gun splashes back and back and back, thinking the destroyer was getting closer. And then eventually they'd say, well, you'll stop to assess. They'd stop and target's gone, we sunk it. No, it's just the splash. So there was, and the way that, to avoid clutter, The fire control radar had like what was called a gate, so it wouldn't take any signals beyond or below a certain range. So there was just this gate. So once you walked the gate, because of reading the splashes off of where the target really was, the target itself wouldn't show up on the radar anymore. So, it's kind of some interesting effects of not quite knowing how to use the equipment yet. So everything actually ran down. It was finally in February of 43 that the Japanese decided to pull the plug on the operation. In the first week of February, they pulled about 10,000 Japanese off and off the island, out of about probably 30 to 40,000 soldiers that had been sent there. But they actually did. It was the first time the Japanese army had decided to actually evacuate soldiers. And it was it was the emperor, I think, who was the impetus behind that. And then on February 9th, Guadalcanal was officially declared secured. So that's kind of, we got a little bit of time for do so. Let me do some questions and answers. If anybody's got any, we got about 10 minutes.
Now, the Battle of Savo Island, there's rumors saying that the Australian cruiser was sunk by our own dudes.
I don't think that's true. It was pretty clearly sunk by long lance torpedoes. I mean, it got hit. It went dead in the water real fast. It lost all power. I mean, it was. I think it's pretty clear it was sunk by the Japanese long lance torpedoes.
Non-U.S. vessels were involved in the battles.
At Savo Island, there were two Australian cruisers. One of them was the flagship. It was actually an Australian admiral. It was a senior admiral there. He was the guy not involved in the fight. There was another Australian cruiser. Was it the Canberra?
Which was
on the southern. The two southern cruisers were the Canberra and the Chicago. The Chicago. The commander of the Chicago was the senior captain in that group. The senior, and he was like clearly flag rank bound, and so he was in charge that day. He misread the whole battle. He didn't really understand where he was getting shot at from. He turned in such a way that he thought he was going after the Japanese and took him completely out of the battle. Then he took a torpedo that took off part of his bow. Couldn't get back in it. The Chicago never fired its main battery. Its secondary batteries fired. They never saw anything. They never had a target. The secondary battery saw a destroyer and engaged it. And he just went up wandering around completely out of the action. But his big problem was he didn't think to tell anybody. He didn't actually, after all this, he didn't even radio a sighting report. So nobody else knew what was going on, even if he'd been able to get through. And his, obviously he didn't make admiral. he did take it to heart, and about 6 months later committed suicide, when he really kind of realized how badly he screwed a pooch that day. When he finally really figured it out how badly he'd done. Yes.
Is that why he committed suicide, truly, you believe, because of that?
Yeah, in fact, he left the suicide. What's that?
What was the reason, please?
That he finally realized what a grave error in judgment he'd made on the day of the battle in terms of all the decisions he'd made and all of the other things he'd failed to do and how many lives it had potentially cost. And he left a suicide note that at the time people didn't understand was a suicide note. You know, it was just a thing saying he understood. He now understood completely his culpability for the losses that took place there and sent that off, and then they found him dead, you know, of obvious suicide. So, yeah. Bode, I think, was his name.
Larry Bond made several scenario for the Guadalcanal campaign in his game Command at Sea. Mm-hmm.
You get a question.
Well, he'd been called before a naval inquiry, and yeah. When he realized what he'd done, he'd been sent back to Panama, and he committed suicide.
He was in Panama, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, as I understand it, he'd been preparing his response, right. and the more he prepared, the more he, you know, the more he kind of really analyzed what he did, the more he really realized.
He's been accused of being a coward. In fact, he wasn't.
He was not a coward.
He proved himself earlier to be quite a aggressive.
Yeah, he was. I haven't heard anybody say that they liked him much. You know, I mean, he was a pretty tough superior officer to be under, not a very nice guy, but. Yeah, but that doesn't mean it. You know, that job wasn't to be a nice guy. But yeah, there's no question he was not a physical coward. He just made some terrible decisions that day. And part of it was because, this goes back to what I talked about earlier, the Navy didn't yet have the mindset of being at war, the sense of urgency, the sense of the importance of every detail in terms of sighting reports, and just having that down as a matter, we were still... intellectually, they were at war, but in terms of your emotional muscle memory, the stuff you do instinctively, it was still peacetime. They just hadn't got on the, in the they hadn't really got into the rhythm of being at war and all that meant.
They had already been at alert for 2 days?
In terms of procedures at the Battle of Savo Island, because they've been alert for 2 days, they were at condition 2, which meant that like the forward turret in each cruiser was fully, one forward turret was manned and the aft turret was half manned. So you had only partial manning. But the big thing was that then, as soon as the Japanese show up and start shooting at them, general quarters, right? All hands to battle stations. Everybody's battle station was different than their watch station. So everybody had to leave where they were and go to a different place in the ship while Japanese shells are crashing. So there's some guys trying to get to places where they can't get there because the companionways have been shot away. One guy was in the forward turret, I think. He's a gunner's mate. And so when the general quarters thing was sounded, he had to make his way down to the armory, get the key to a 3-inch anti-aircraft magazine, go unlock that magazine so that they could get those rounds to the 3-inch guns, and then get to his other battle station. I mean, it was just nuts. I mean, there were so many things going on that weren't war ready in terms of our procedures yet. But all that changed by the end of this. I mean, that's really the amazing thing about this is by the end of this campaign, boy, the U.S. Navy is really ready to go. I mean, they've worked a lot of that stuff out. They've worked out the leadership problems. They've worked out a lot of the stuff on radar. Yeah, David.
So you were saying that obviously there's a lot of after-action analysis and then sharing that information with other units in the U.S. Navy so it improved everyone. But they did not understand the long-lance torpedo's capabilities immediately.
Right.
What I'm interested in is, when did the Japanese figure out that we had this huge advantage in radar that was just chewing them up?
I'm not sure. That's a real good question. I think
some of the books that I read said that they never did.
That they never understood that? Yeah, they certainly didn't get it during this period.
I don't know how they would be able to figure that out, except for the American gunnery is amazingly effective.
Uh-huh.
You know?
But sometimes, of course, it wasn't. You know, like, for example, at Tisafarangas, in that one, the gunnery was not particularly good, was it? Even though it was radar-directed.
So they wouldn't pick up on it.
Yeah.
There'd be no way to backtrack and analyze it like we did with the long-lance torpedoes by saying, obviously, we're being hit at a range that we didn't expect to be hit.
Mm-hmm.
We knew it wasn't gunnery, ergo, must have been the torpedoes.
And with the long lance, it wasn't just range. It was also a question of range and speed. I mean, we could get a lot of range out of a torpedo, but you can set it at a lower speed and get more range.
Right.
The big thing about the long lance was they got that range at a very high speed. So when you encounter someone coming towards you, you know, well, they can't get that range until this point because it's got to be a lower speed. But that wasn't true with the long lance. And so that was the part of the equation that was very difficult to kind of figure out.
49 knot top speed.
Yeah, that's short range. But they have pretty good speed for long range, too.
Warhead was almost twice that of a U.S. torpedo.
Mm. Was it? Yeah, I know it was a lot bigger. It was certainly bigger.
It was close to almost a half a ton.
Mm-hmm.
And it did leave a bubble trail.
Right, right.
So it was running underwater?
Yeah.
Well, also, it was not a... it was...
It was an oxygen-fed torpedo that left no weight.
Right, yeah.
That's impressive because underwater, your drag goes up by the fourth power of your speed.
Mm-hmm.
So that takes a lot of energy.
Yeah.
And plus, the torpedo was like 24 inches in
diameter. It was a great big torpedo. But I mean, they developed it. I mean, they kind of figured out. The Japanese figured out that that's what they needed, and they really worked hard. In a lot of ways, the destroyer force was the elite force of the Japanese Navy. The torpedo men, you know, were the guys that were really expected to take it to the enemy. And the Japanese destroyers were really good in this. Were very, very well handled. There was a destroyer admiral named Tanaka who was for a while in charge of the off and on in charge of the Tokyo Express. And he's the guy that was actually in charge at Tessa Farongo. And I mean, it's just a, that's a he didn't get to unload much supply. The supplies didn't get ashore, but boy, did he chew up. I mean, think about that the discrepancy of force at Tessa Farongo. Five Allied cruisers and 6 destroyers against 8 Japanese destroyers. And the Japanese just handed them their lunch, right? 3 cruisers sunk, 1 damaged, 1 Japanese destroyer sunk. And none of the others were even touched. Yeah.
I'd like to ask you, and if you don't have the answer to the room, have you heard of a historian out of San Francisco and predominantly, I think, Japanese World War II history named Douglas Dietrich? And if so, what do you think of his
information? I'm not familiar with him, but maybe somebody else.
I've heard of him, but I've never read anything that he has.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you. He's got a lot of back information that I've never heard that they kind of covered up or never heard.
The Japanese did take one of their light cruisers and made it a torpedo cruiser. I mean, it had 6 launchers of 4 tubes on each side. So it had like 10 launchers of long-lance torpedoes.
We're at 5:32,
okay.
So we have to quit, right? Or no, we actually go to 6. We can go to 6. I was thinking 5:30.
Yeah, quarter of. Because
quarter of.
The transition.
Okay.
Right.
So we've still got like 13 more minutes.
Right. Yes, you do.
13 more minutes, okay.
Was Dietrich one of the 2 authors that did Shattered Sword?
I have no idea, but
he's
got a website, and he's based out of San Francisco.
I thought he might. I don't remember.
His stuff's super interesting. I don't know if it's true.
There was a book about the Japanese side.
I read that book.
But those 2 different American authors who got into the archives on the Japanese side, and I thought maybe he was one.
He has like a bunch of archives. He worked at the Presidio. I don't know, but he's been radio interviewed, and he's just got all this information that no one's ever come out with, and about different aspects of the war. And I just, if anyone else said no, if he's fully or if he's...
There's something interesting is that those archival records of the Japanese, because they, you know, obviously World War II was not something they were encouraged to study.
Mm-hmm.
Right now it's still very controversial. And so they never had like an official history done, like even in Germany, there's an official history that has been done of World War II. They did World War I, they did World War II. I don't believe it's been translated into English, so I was just interested whether the Japanese had the same thing, even if it was Japanese.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the interesting thing, is that yes, it finally has been done, and it's been translated into Dutch. Because the Dutch, for some reason, really wanted to have these records, because again, of all the things they did in World War II, they had a huge action out in the Pacific, which we forget, you know, the Dutch East Indies, Borneo, all that. And their navy obviously got hammered, but it's also where they had the greatest amount of fighting.
Sure,
and
that's where their navy was.
Yes.
You know,
the British.
Yes, but the British don't care.
But the British main part of the fleet was in the Atlantic, basically the whole Dutch fleet. It was in the Pacific.
There's a plan to do it in English also, but what's interesting, what I found, was that the Japanese official record, obviously early war, because that's where the Dutch are involved, is that it was being translated from Japanese
to Dutch.
Dutch, okay?
Yeah.
Which still doesn't help me, but it's closer to getting to English.
Yeah, on a slightly divergent thing, I was looking at a website that's got a fair amount of order of battle information. That's usually pretty good information. And Leo Niehorster's site, I don't know if anybody's looked at that. But one of the things I got interested, he's got a little thing on the, you know, the Dutch East Indies.
Mm-hmm.
I looked at that it's from the Dutch sources, and it's got everything. I mean, it's got number of armored cars and the individual detachments. It's a staggering. It's like the Dutch really take that campaign seriously, and they're really interested in the history of that campaign. So I'm sure that I hadn't really connected, but now that I think about the Dutch information available on the ground forces, it kind of makes sense that they translate the Japanese history.
Oh yeah,
because they are real serious.
I did pick up over at Pacificon one time. From Scale Specialist, the Cruiser After Report. I still have it.
Whose cruiser after Red?
Which cruiser?
U.S.
Oh, U.S., okay.
And there was a lot of, like, confusing... It was definitely where they were so confused of what was going on.
You mean for Savo Island, or...
The entire Pacific.
Oh, okay.
Especially during that time. It was all nothing cruisers and destroyers.
So, anything else? Yes.
I have a little story. I heard, you can tell me if it's true or not, I heard that during one of the battles, naval battles, that there was a guy on the front of a ship, and there was a storm. It wasn't during a battle, I think. It was during a storm. And on the ship, there was a huge wave that came over the front of the ship and swept him off the ship into the ocean, and there was a ship behind him, and it was going, it's what's the front of the ship called?
Bow.
It was down, it was lowered, and the wave just put him right on the
deck. I have no idea. I've never heard that story. I suppose
was
it can happen.
Michael Savage, and he was telling the story about
it. Yeah, I've never heard that. There is a, in the, I think it's in the Battle of, the Battle of Santa Cruz, another example of the U.S. Shooting itself in the foot. The Wasps, I think it's the Wasps, as soon as the Japanese aircraft show up, the first thing that the Wasp does is the commander of the aft battery of 5-inch AA guns, 3-inch AA guns, I think. 3-inch or 5-inch? Maybe they're 5-inch. 5-inch AA guns. He was a young ensign who wasn't really very experienced, and he cranked the guns to full elevation and ran them into the stops and froze them all. So basically put his own battery, which is to say all the 5-inchers in aft of the superstructure out of action before they fired a shot. And I think it was in the same action where the first casualty in ship casualty in the Enterprise's task force was caused by an Enterprise plane because an Avenger came back and it was crippled and it got waved off, and then it was too low on fuel, and the guy put it in the drink, and a destroyer came up to get him out of the drink. And as they were pulling him out of the drink, they sighted a torpedo, and it turns out that when he put his Avenger in the water, his torpedo broke loose, started up, came around, and hit the destroyer that was pulling him out of the drink.
It was on first, right?
I know.
There.
So,
one last thing.
Yes.
Is that Gormley was... obviously a micromanager, and he was, he wanted to do as much as he could, and that was the problem. Is that they needed a leader. They needed an attitude change. As Frank was saying about the U.S. Navy, is they still had a mentality that it was peacetime, even though they intellectually realized it was war, and they really needed somebody to get in there and kick butt. And Halsey was sent to do exactly that.
Yes.
Okay, and so one of my favorite anecdotes is they're asking Halsey. By the way, Halsey's one of the only guys to get on the cover of Time magazine twice in World War II. Okay? Almost everybody did, a lot of different generals and admirals. He got on there twice because he was one very quotable, okay? So he's about ready to go out and take command of Southwest Pacific.
Or South Pacific?
South Pacific, okay? And the reporters are sitting there saying, well, what are your orders, Admiral? And he looked at him and he said, kill Japs, kill more Japs. That's it.
Wow.
Yes. So they loved him.
I think didn't they paint that on the flight deck of one of the carriers?
Yes. Yes.
Was it the Philippine Sea or something?
Spruance was very intellectual and very smart guy. He was a cruiser admiral who they gave command of our carriers
for Midway.
Yes, even though technically Fletcher was in control, he looked at Spruance and said, no, whatever you want to do, I'll make sure everybody does this. That's how highly they regarded his intellect, right? But Halsey was considered to be a sailor's admiral, right? And here's a great story about him, is that there were these guys on a carrier in line. There's ice cream. American Navy, we got ice cream, right? So the guys are all standing in line, and it's got officers and enlisted men standing there, and there's a long line for this, right? It's hot. Okay, so these two ensigns,
we're new and we're officers and all these enlisted men. Screw that. We're going to walk right up to the front of the line, right? Because we're going to front and rock in front of all these even chief petty officers. So they're walking up there, and then somebody else says, "Hey, where are you going?" Right? And they turn around, ready to, you know, badmouth these sailors. Guess who it is?
Halsey.
Halsey, who says, "Go to the end of the line now," right? Of course, all the sailors just love him, right? Because it's like, oh no, Halsey's standing there waiting for the, you know, the enlisted sailors and chief petty officers to get their ice cream, and then he'll take his turn. They loved him. They absolutely loved him. So, yeah, Halsey's...
He had a tremendous sense of personal leadership.
Oh, my gosh, yes, absolutely. Anyway, thank you, Frank. Thank you very much. Thank you, everyone, for coming to the War College here at Celesticon 2014.